Welcome all. Welcome all to the show. We got Patrick Crane introducing him onto the show. Welcome.
Thank you. Hello. How are you?
I'm good.
How's everybody doing?
Thank you. And Tom is back as usual. Welcome.
Thank you. Way back when in 67, I truly was the Dandy of Yamakai.
Hell of a guy, Dan McKay. So we are talking about the one and only Donald Fagen, Walter Becker, and their Steely Dan crowd. And again, they worked for various labels, ABC, Warner Brothers, MCA Records, and they were just always in my life. I was just always, they were one of my dad's favorite bands that he had always seen in concert. There's even a GeoCities-esque looking site that, I kid you not, has not been updated template-wise, but has still been keeping track of all their various tours. And yeah, they bring up good points on who was on what tour, and people forget that Michael McDonald of the Doobie Brothers started out with them as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I always had their various albums. I've listened to a bunch of them, especially Can't Buy a Frill and Aja are ones. But yeah, I've always been a fan, and I just think they're just a hell of a group who, you know, for a rock band, they insert jazz and pop into it. I think that's why they've just become so popular as they are. And it's just cool just knowing that. I mean, when Fagen passed, was it Becker or Fagen who passed away recently? Becker passed away, and they kind of got into an argument on who was owed residuals from whose estate, because they also contributed lyrics. But overall, I think they've been a pretty cool band, because I saw a bunch of their documentaries growing up, and they just seemed like they were an unofficial family in a way, you know?
Yeah, and for me, I grew up listening to them just on FM radio. But as I've gotten older, I've started to pick out good things. Like you mentioned, the thing that if you use jazz in there. And that in of itself makes it hard for me to categorize them as rock or pop or whatever, because it truly transcended all the genres that it was connected to.
Don't lose my number.
Yeah. Exactly. And just listening to some of the other ones, like from Pretzel Logic and some of the other songs.
Another one, Reeling in the Years.
I was picking out different, there's a song with a little bit of country twang to it at the very beginning. Hey 19 is one of my favorites, because it has that nice little almost bluesy riff at the very beginning. And that's what makes them so special, because they're able to take so many different sources
styles.
Of inspiration.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sources of inspiration and turn it into just magical music that transcends even popular music of the day.
Yeah. And I mean, I was listening to them. My mother would listen to a lot of 80s stuff, like Pointer Sisters and even Rick Astley. And I listened to a bunch of Steely Dan, along with plenty of the other ones like Van Halen and even a lot of the more recent kind of heavy metal and hard rock. And I was just one of those, it's like, I loved it all. And their lyrics did really speak to me in a way. I just really just found them just not just pleasant, but also just kind of everyday kind of feel. I just, all music refers to them being just very sophisticated, and but what they definitely touch on the most in their section is definitely on how their melodies are just so well thought out. And all together, like you guys say, it's just more than comfort food. It's comfort food with a heart, you know?
Exactly.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say it's most definitely comfort food with a heart and a brain as well, because that's obviously the thing that really has made them a lasting band is the is the sophistication in their lyrics, and not just also mm-hmm. In their music as well. And their lyrics are so great, and they paint such a unique, sort of dark noirish look.
It is very detective noirish.
And it's just and it's sort of Raymond Carver ish because it's really just about regular people, and there's always some sort of sinister thing going on in their lyrics. And I think that's what kind of gives Steely Dan in the 70s, they feel like the 70s, at least the majority of their work, because that's when it was produced, but they sound like that decade, like no other band. That they mm-hmm. sound like what if 70s California had a sound, it would sound like Steely Dan. It embodies that era. And everybody listened to them, and they were so popular. But what was kind of irreverent about them is that, their lyrics were really very kind of dark and very taboo in some ways. Some of the subject matter.
Becker and Fagan were once dubbed the Manson and Starkwater rock and roll.
and even because their
tours album. Were hectic, and they used to write for Barbra Streisand, and they later collaborated with Carole King on the Jazzmen single. But yeah, like you say, is like they overcame their demons in a way. Like again, it was Fagan, I think, who had stage fright at first. And even though he didn't realize this is how you're going to make a living, you got to be doing touring in addition to recording, But yeah, like you say, it isn't, it's a pleasant pop melody, although much like most electronic and pop, it is often talking about a very hard to talk about subject matter sometimes, that's just how they've come around.
Yeah, and even listening to some of their later albums, you can tell the same kind of dark energies in there. What really got me though was just looking back at some of the titles of the songs and the albums. I'm a word guy, so I love language, and so anytime
you don't want mindless clever lyrics.
Turn of a phrase, anything like that, they hit right on there. Elevated them in my mind, and just once you get past the titles, the lyrics, like you said, they go into a lot deeper, thought-provoking element, because you can only do Ron Ron every so often before you kind of said, you know what, I kind of need to hear something else.
I definitely think so. I mean. They toured in 2019 with Steve Winwood, and I think that's just icing on the cake, because I was raised on his music as well, and I thought he was another one. And then, formerly of the band Chicago, he would just sing about various progressive things that happened in his life, as opposed to, hey, I'm pretty, hey, I got dancing numbers, or with today's deal, where it's just like, hey, I'm auto-tuned, so everything's, writes itself technically. And it's just so funny how they got their name, because it was like off a masturbation device. And I would always hear about that, but I thought it was just people making shit up, or it was a satire. And it's like, nope, that's legit what they were. That's where their name came from. It says, what is it called? It's my Steely Dan. but yeah, so I take it both of you guys got most of their albums, I guess.
Oh yeah.
I came across the way I absorbed them. They were obviously always big on the radio in my childhood, but around 99 or something, I think I bought that Citizen Steely Dan box set, which at the time was everything they had recorded, because they had not yet come back with Two Against Nature. So when I had this box set, I was in the right place at the right time to actually absorb it. I was in California for a bit, and I would drive, up and down the 15, and I would listen to this all these CDs, and I would really like back it up and listen to each song over and over again. That's how I kind of came into them, and I absorbed, I mean, all of their albums, I remember, in a summer, and it was a really nice way to sort of collect all of their stuff because it was in one box set.
Right? And the fandom lives on. I see so many people of different ages who are really into them, whether it's, you know, their parents or anything. There's a lot of great cover bands. I found out that the Steely Dead, which is a combo of them and the Grateful Dead, is a thing. My father's seen Naked Lunch, which is their another tribute band in Dallas, a few times, and they're apparently very true to the music. Steely Dane is one that's the heaviest promoted, and Humphreys McGee has done a bunch of mashups of their songs. It seems like, again, just the lyrics, like you guys say, are accessible, the tones are great, and the talent really shows with, again, the difficult subject matter that is displayed and made so seamless.
Yeah, and it's sneaky the way they do it. It's almost like they give a wink and a nod to it while
Everyone's at the movies. I didn't right know. Out there. I didn't know that everyone's right at the movies. Yeah. It was about pornography.
Yeah. And dealing with underage people too. I mean, underage kids. That's the thing about Steely Dan is that when you're a Steely Dan fan, I mean, that their lyrics are like they feel like in jokes between them. Some of their lyrics
are very sarcastic
I'm one that finds other people's in jokes funny. I don't know what that is. I appreciate that kind of banter. And so their lyrics and their interplay between the two of them is sort of, you know, just right up my alley.
Too cute for its own good. It's just right. It's just perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the thing and the thing that also really stood out to me is the fact that they used different studio musicians all the way through. And to me to be able to hit again and again and again with the same kind of writing, the same kind of lyrical side of it. And it just blows me away. The only people I can think of off the top of my head that would rival that today would be a band called Here Come the Mummies.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They're all studio musicians, and they wail. But Steely Dan, in its own way, wails on a completely different level than everybody else. They hit a lot of the emotional cores, the people who, like you said, the in jokes.
In jokes, and they are about big, hard to talk about topics. It's not just when I grow up, I'm gonna marry.
And to be honest, one of my favorite album covers of all time is Pretzel Logic, because because your mind takes it one direction, and then on the cover there's a guy selling hot pretzels.
Yeah. Just another day, eh? You know,
that's right.
They definitely have that middle class kind of working style, as opposed to, you know, you're hearing the lyrics from someone who's just very privileged or, you know, mm-hmm. better off, you know, doing anything. And so, like you say, they are very vulnerable and very, you kind of feel that natural chaos that they're trying to illustrate, that day to day, 9 to 5, when I get off work, you know. my father especially reacted the most to don't lose my number, because it's like, it's the only one you got. And I think now in a cell phone age, that's, I can see that song kind of hitting the nail on the head a little harder, just because I mean, the lyric that they analyze the most is, it's the only one you got, you know. It's just like, man, that's serious, you know.
Now granted, it doesn't rank up there with the lyrical brilliance that is Call Me Maybe.
Yeah. It could very well be inspired by that.
Now, one of the things that... Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was not a finished spot.
One of the things that I kind of gather from it, just from listening to them, is they seem to be talking about things that either they experienced or that they knew people who experienced this, that kind of thing. So it was kind of like the 50s and 60s, they kind of pulled everything back to reveal, okay, here's some of the crap that was going on, here's some of the things that they told you was going on, but that was actually something a little bit darker.
They shied away, they sugarcoated it, yeah.
Yeah. Fearless in that regard.
Very fearless. They were one of the many who you can tell every time they're talked about in interviews, they basically put the most effort, not into their life, but into their work. And so it was just reckless amount of hours, and it paid off apparently. But it was also one of those where you can kind of get a sense that they didn't get too many notes, because generally a lot of their topics just weren't all that well known or don't come off that way. They had the appeal already there, and their records were selling. So you can kind of tell that they were able to get away with what they did, you know?
Mm-hmm. And then go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say they were much more beats than they were hippies in that sense. They were more, they were more enamored with the time that they grew up in, but they weren't burning the system down. They were exposed to the system, you know, for its flaws. Yeah. And obviously a lot of the same kind of thematic things that everybody was concerned about, like hypocrisy and all these kinds of things, ran through their music as well. But yeah, they were definitely out of step in terms of their songwriting peers. In that they were, you know, they had much more a black coffee and cigarette kind of duo than, you know, hard drinking and, you know, that kind of deal. Even though, you know, I know that they imbibed, and and that Walter Becker, in fact, had a really horrible heroin habit at some point. But yeah, you know, they were much, much out of step with their contemporaries, which made their popularity seem so kind of out of left field in a way, because they didn't really sound like anybody else. I know a lot of people like this today, a lot of kids, reasons that like young people like them is there is sort of on like like almost a semi-ironic love for this thing called yacht rock, you know, which everybody loves to talk about yacht rock. And, you know, they talk about bands like, you know, I guess what, Toto, and I don't know who the hell
those else are definitely, they're entering these subgenres. And like you say, they're part of a scene, but they're not really belonging here. Right. They're creating their own scene. And I guess you could say the independent nature of them and a lot of just great kick-ass just riffs in their music and guitars just really set them and make them welcome at any scene. But much like we've talked about a bunch of edgy TV shows from all eras on this show, and we've talked about how they've been ignored by the awards, yet even though the Phantom is there, it's like they hit so close to home. And so it is cool to see a band like this get a bunch of critical recognition, even though they are talking about just very often just not, you know, people often just want you to sell a record and not be deep, and they're still very daring.
Yeah, and that way they're a lot like another band of their contemporaries, the band Rush.
Is just stellar. Everything.
Yeah, between Steve Lagan and Rush, you could have an intellectual feast for days, just going over their lyrics or listening to the music and picking out certain things that you really like, a turn of a phrase here or a drum beat there or a guitar riff here. And like I said, you could feast for days just going over that stuff, and you would still find stuff to keep you going well beyond the point where you have exhaustion.
Absolutely.
If you threw Zap in there, you could do it for a lifetime too. Another guy who knew how to turn a phrase and play a guitar, and also had some very disciplined musicians at his hand.
Oh, yeah. Hell, you're talking about the younger crowds. When looking up a perfect promo photo, which I ended up using, I found that there was a bunch of how to play Steely Dan music, you know, for people ages 10 and up. That's relatively pretty recent, where that came with a CD and everything. I was like, how cool. So it's cool when you see people want to actually, you know, to become talented, you have to study the greats and get a copy of the music notes, you know, for instrument playing. And so I find it cool that there was a CD, interactive CD that they endorsed that had, you know, just how to play their various music cues.
Yeah.
And to that, I got to say this, you know, you don't, and this is something that nobody really thinks about, a Steely Dan. And you said something about it earlier, is that, you know, for all of these bands that have these great guitarists that shred, Steely Dan always has killer guitar solos.
Yeah.
All of their albums, a lot of their singles.
It's not repetitive
that are popular,
either.
Yeah. They're perfectly timed. And they're incredibly intricate. They're pretty mind-blowing.
We'll return after these messages.
Do you ever find yourself thinking about who would win in a fight between Goku and Superman? Hi, I'm James Gavsey, and on the Who Would Win show, me and my co-host Ray ignore anything important happening in the outside world and debate fictional battles between characters from comics, movies, and video games.
We got a new show every week, and almost always am I the winner.
Yeah, not true, Ray.
In the past, we've discussed such matches as Captain America versus Darth Vader, Solid Snake versus the Iron Giant, classic matchups like RoboCop versus Terminator, and even the Muppets versus Sesame Street.
That one was crazy. So if you're a fan of geek culture and love a spirited debate, check out the Who Would Win show wherever you get your podcasts, or check us out at whowouldwinshow.com.
We let things pile up in the DVR. We add them to our queues. We wait for the DVDs and Blu-rays. We time shift. The Time Shifters podcast. Sci-fi, horror, fantasy, superheroes, comedy, action, film, television, maybe some not-so-current events. Find us on iTunes or at timeshifterspodcast.com.
Cool thing about Blind Knowledge is we are in multiple countries. We are worldwide, all across the globe. We are in the U.S. We are in the U.K. We are in Canada, Germany, India, Japan. We're in Australia, y'all. BlindKnowledge.com. Now back to the feature presentation.
Dragon Ball Z, One Piece, Naruto, all things that we love, all manga that were originally published in the legendary magazine Weekly Shonen Jump.
But not every series can run for 300 chapters and have a hit anime. This is David.
This is Jordan.
We're the hosts of Shonen Flop. Each episode we look at manga that ran in Jump that didn't quite make it.
We discuss what it did wrong, what it did right, how the series could have turned itself around, and ultimately, was it a flop or not?
Run all your favorite podcast apps, and you can find us at shonenflop.com.
Keep on flopping, floppers.
But they're so well placed that they kind of sneak by you, and that's what the joy about Steely Dan is, going back and picking out these little parts of the instrumentation that's in the music and thinking, wow, that's really incredible. Like how that's pulled off.
Yeah.
Anyone who I know who hasn't cared for it, a la my sister, is often just not really. It's kind of like when people, you know, who don't like rap or metal, is like they're just hearing it, but they're not paying attention to it, and they just don't like the sound of it. And it is one of those, is like they get even more wicked when you focus your attention, like you say, on the instrumentals versus the lyrics versus the certain segments of the songs. It is very electrifying when you're just like, whoa, yeah, that's right. Concentrate on this aspect of it. And when there's ever a chorus that comes in, it is always just, it does always feel like it belongs. It doesn't feel like a studio note or just a last minute insertion, you know?
Yeah. And that's exactly it. And yeah, I also go back to some of the people and groups that Steel Dan has inspired, and just think about their virtuosity, how well they do it. Like Howard Jones, he was really inspired by Steely Dan. And on, I think it was one of his greatest hits album, where he talked about he actually got to see somebody play the guitar that was used on Reeling in the Years, and it blew him away.
Oh, wow. Man. The War on Drugs, recently, the lead singer of that, his guitar that he uses apparently was used by Steely Dan, apparently, in an auction.
Wow.
And wow, he uses it as his warm-up, and it's not even the one he goes on tour with. It's just what he uses in the studio for the various demo sessions. And when he was asked, he's like, this was, I found this out like earlier this year. And when he was asked, like, where did you come across it? This is like at an auction. But yeah, there's definitely, like you say, it is fun to kind of reel back and see what artists respect and love one another and actually take to heart the inspiration. It isn't just, I want to be the next version of you. It's like, yeah, no, I'm very inspired, and I'm going to pay tribute when the time comes. That's kind of the fun and love that we're seeing here.
Absolutely. And I like the, going back to, Steely Dan was very dark, but when you compare it to Donald Fagen's The Nightfly, it's a shade difference completely.
Nightfly is still one of, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Nightfly's one of my favorite albums of the 80s, period, hands down. And the more I listen to it as I get older, the more I pick out that kind of feel, and it's just, it still blows me away in a time of technological advances, having something so simple, but yet so endearing and so attractive, it just digs into you to the point where you can't help but listen to it and feel great while you do it.
Totally. I will definitely applaud him for that, because, you know, like Patrick was definitely reeling in, you know, earlier, it was like, to talk about dark subjects, you know, some people feel like you've got to assert all this grim grittiness, and that is, again, you know, as part of their irony, is like, they are talking about all this off-color subject matter, but they kind of have that gist of, well, what the hell am I gonna do, you know. And they kind of just, they, much like their music career, they embrace it, and they just, when the lyrics come to them, they unleash them. And I don't know who they're going to get next to kind of lead the band, but, you know, there's definitely still, the love is still felt. And I think I would not be surprised if they go out and try some other solo work that gets played at festivals or on college radio and the well-funded station. If anyone's got any PBS or KERA thing or Austin, or something similar to Woodstock or Austin City Limits, that's an annual event, I'm sure someone, you're bound to see some artist that's gonna do a cover of a Steely Dan song or be very similarly influenced by it. It is just one of those that has, like you say, somehow ruptured through the ice and carried on through. And it is just so interesting who, like you say, just seeing them listed along with some other big names who they couldn't be any different from, and yet they still also ironically feel like they belong there. It's like, yeah, sure, put them up there with those guys, those greats.
Absolutely. And when
I wouldn't also discount, you know, Walter Becker also released two solo albums. You know, Donald Fagen,
yeah,
did The Nightfly and Kamakiria, and he's since released Morph the Cat and Sunken Condos. But Walter Becker's 11 Tracks of Whack is really excellent. I'm sure, you know, Steely Dan fans really dig it, but you know, that's a great album and really shows,
I think my father listened to it, he really loved it.
It's great. It really showed how Steely Dan was more than just Donald Fagen, how it really was, you know, two parts, two halves of a whole,
Becker, in terms Fagen, of what and a great crew. Yeah.
Yeah. And a Rolodex, as they used to say. you know, because they started, they began life as an actual band. David Palmer was their lead singer, and you know, he was the what they used to call the Daltrey, the Roger Daltrey of the group. But of course, he only lasted for one album. But that core band stayed together for their first three albums, and then a little bit into KD Live. But they decided they didn't want to tour anymore, so they stopped touring.
There are
and they stopped touring after Pretzel Logic, and that's when Skunk Baxter left and formed or went to the Doobie Brothers, because he was like, well, you know, because that's how they make their money. They don't really make, if you know you're not in a, if you're in a band, you know, that's where you really make most of your money, on touring. Unless you're songwriters, which Becker and Fagan got all the money for the songwriting.
Yeah, so everyone else is,
so yeah. Everyone else just kind of sitting around on salary, but they're not really making a lot of money. And so, you know,
and they're Becker not being really just challenged as an artist, and you kind of want to challenge, right, if you're going to take on anything. But that I'm glad that you brought that up. There are definitely parallels between, it's just like with the Who, is like, who deserves more of the credits, Townsend or Daltrey, when they're both bringing a lot to the whole scene. And then, same thing with Becker, right, and Fagan, is like, I mean, we've seen this with any other kind of fandom. Everyone likes to choose a camp. It's like, no, they all earned their keep. Just acknowledge them all.
Yeah, exactly. Another band that had a similar formula and had varying lots of success was Alan Parsons Project. But those two were, you could say they're diametrically opposed, but they had the same kind of mentality when it came to making a record and getting the right musicians in there. And Alan Parsons to this day goes out and does concerts, and he gathers just some amazing people. I wouldn't be surprised if Donald Fagan does something similar, because I think he has that kind of touch. And
everyone seems to know his name. You know, it's just like with the Beatles, you know, Paul McCartney's name meant just as much, maybe even more in some circles, you know, as John Lennon. So it's just like, he can carry a crowd. He's got his loyal fans and new people who have heard of his talent or heard him in some capacity. So regardless of the age or generation, it's like that they got enough. They picked enough brains to where they could definitely get seated at a proper corner, deserving of their talent and where to play. Yeah.
And across the great span of music, I will honestly say that Steely Dan was lightning in a bottle. I've looked at some other bands after them, like Spandau Ballet and Kaja Gugu, who also tried to bring in elements of jazz into their popular music and didn't do as well as Steely Dan did. So to me, that just makes what Steely Dan was able to do just puts it on a, just blows everything else out of the water.
Yeah. And it's hard, because when you come in the wake of someone's fame, you got producers who they want you to be like that other similar artist that sold this X amount of records. And then you got the, you know, you're going to get some snobby reviews one way or the other about, knockoff band, you know, number one for 10. And so it's hard, especially if you are just coincidentally similar and you're, regardless of how you're marketed, is like, well, we're going to mix jazz. It's hard to classify us in one brand of music.
Yeah. And you also have to have people willing to commit to it. That's the other thing. You can't half-ass something like this. You have to have people who get it and are saying, you know what, I get it and I want to be part of it.
You do have to embrace your ego. You can't just be, you know, like Nickelback, where I don't care what people think. Like eventually it catches up with you after a while, especially if you don't take yourself all that seriously. It's like, whatever, dude.
Yeah, if you don't take yourself seriously, eventually nobody will take you seriously.
Yeah. And I mean, you could also say that about ego. You can think you're awesome, but if you really don't believe it, or if you're not trying to be awesome, then eventually you don't really have much of a crowd. It also is just kind of, but you know, we're talking in earlier time too. We're talking 70s and 80s, and to prosper during two totally different eras, you know, just decades apart, you know, is a pretty cool blessing. Well, what would you say was their high point? Was it definitely the earlier albums, or just as a whole, a kind of pretty consistent?
I mean, you know, in terms of, I think, commercial success, and I think their Asia is probably what everybody would say was their like commercial peak, I guess, because that album was so ubiquitous.
That it's definitely one I heard a lot too. Yeah.
It was all over the place, and it still stands as technically one of their most impressive achievements. Steely Dan was one of those bands, in my opinion, they never released a bum album, and they never released an album that was any less than amazing, in my opinion. I even think Anything Must Go is a really good album, and I think it's a great closer. I think they right. stick the landing really well on accident. Obviously, they had no foresight that Walter, this would be really their last album, a studio album. But, there are very few bands that have a career that lasts as long, that produces as much material. I mean, they didn't produce a ton, but they produced enough material.
Amount still.
Yes. Yeah. that has a reach, that has the kind of legs and influence that Steely Dan does. And they also sound, they're one of these bands, it's so weird, they very much sound of their time, and they also sound not of their time. They sound timeless. They're not like, you know, again, there are 70s bands that sound, they sound like a 70s band. I could be wrong, but they don't wallow in a very in one kind of very watered down West Coast jazz pop sensibility. They do incorporate, as y'all were saying earlier, a lot of different styles into the music, which I think is what gives it the legs that it has.
Yeah, and that's a great point, because jazz, as we know it, it can be very improvisational. It can be just, it doesn't fit into any one box. It could be fast, it could be slow, it could have some blues involvement in it. It could be light and airy and poppy, and that in and of itself is what I think makes Steely Dan timeless. The fact that it doesn't stay in its lane. It has no real lane to stay in.
1,000%.
Right. It sort of owns the road that it's on. You know, it sort of charts its own course, and you know. And I gotta say this also, that what I love so much about Steely Dan's story is that Gaucho, which, you know, at the time, you know, was sort of had mixed reviews, now is seen as such a great album. And I think it's I don't know if it's my favorite, but it's one of them. I love how it sounds like 19, like it sounds like the hangover of the 70s. It sounds like the party is over, we're kind of done.
Ironic of every party. Yeah,
it's a very dark, and it's a very dark album. It ends on a very sardonic note with Third World Man, but I like that they knew exactly when to pull back and not sully their discography with half, you know, attempted albums that were not, you know, that were below their fighting weight. Mm-hmm. I like that they knew that they were precise.
They were in it to win it, and at the same time, you know, they weren't going to start it off to begin with if it was already half-assed, you know.
Yeah, you wouldn't see Steely Dan doing rap or polka. You, although they could have succeeded with that, with how talented they are. But really, you don't. You'd say they stuck to what they knew, threw in some additional flavors here and there, but stuck to what they did, what they knew, what they loved, and that joy of producing something so spectacular. I mean, the very fact we're having this conversation in 2022 tells me that there's still a lot of passion out there.
Yeah, and we all legit dig them, as opposed to let's just talk about them for popularity's sake. And it's like, no, we legit dig this band. We think they're one of the greats.
Oh. Yeah, and they're easy to discover and get into too. Because again, even though they produced enough work, you can listen to it all in a day if you really want. I mean, it's not like
it's not like 20 plus albums. Yeah.
I mean, and it's pleasant. And it's it's like it goes down easy, and it's, you know, it's easy to, you know, kind of wrap your hands around in terms of, oh, I could do this, I can listen to it, but it's deceptive because there's so much to it.
Mm-hmm. Totally. This has been a delight having you guys on here.
Oh yeah, thank you,
Patrick. Yeah, is there anything you would like to promote?
Well, you know, I, you know, I'm supposed to be promoting my writing on ApolloTwin.com, which is where I do all of my, where I publish all of my essays on film. But nice. I have not published anything in a couple of few weeks, and I'm supposed to be getting back to it. And it looks like my Michael Mann series that I began last year will be what I'm picking back up.
Oh,
so I should be nice. I should be publishing my, all of them are on there. On in the Hall of Fame, I have a Hall of Fame place where you can find Michael Mann's work. All of it's in there.
Would love to have you on for that episode.
Oh yeah, yeah, I'm all for it. I'm getting ready to dive into the robbery homicide division TV series. So my next essay that I'm getting ready to tackle. So I'm getting ready to publish a heat essay, I think, here in the next week or so.
Yeah.
So that's what I've got.
I recommend you check out the show Ray Donovan. We at one point. Someone's like, this is a Michael Mann moment. And it's like, yeah, I totally was getting Heat, Collateral vibes.
Right.
Oh, and it's cool to know that there is an increase in people want to see how an artist evolved in any kind of realm of entertainment. Because it seems like, you know, you kind of need that to have a complete review. It's like, where does it rank in terms of, you know, other than the best and worst, why did it earn said ranking? You know, why did it do so well?
Oh, absolutely.
So thank you all once again for joining us and having a fun, orderly chat. This was delightful.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a Jacked Up.